Well, good morning and welcome to another Bible class at Triangle Bible Church. Glad to see everybody here this morning, and spring's in the air, baseball's in the air. Normal people can talk to each other again, and instead of grunts and things like that, football. But anyway, just trying to irritate you a little bit. Couple of announcements before we get ourselves underway this morning. I was given this announcement just before Bible class. Our own little Andy back there. What did you do this in preparation or?
Yeah, this is for St.
Baldrick's
Day.
For what? Oh, so you shaved the head for cancer?
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, he's going to be that way for a little while, apparently, because he has been officially sworn into the United States Air Force. Congratulations. That wasn't for you two, just walking in. That would happen. Timing is just perfect. It says tentative date to leave is September or October. Well, that's rather liberal. September or October.
Well, it is the Air Force.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Your dad hadn't been needling you at all about Air Force, has he? Oh, okay. It says that prayers are desperately needed for mom. Well. Yeah, that's right. Well, all right. We'll follow your training and career and have you in our prayer and see how things go. Are there any other announcements that you'd like to make the assembly aware of this morning? Anything that... Well, somebody picked one of them up. There's one notebook out there, back there, that we're not sure whose it is. There's no name or anything in it, but if it's yours, why, it's back there. And I don't know, that could be somebody from 1994 or something. I don't know, but if that's your notebook, it's back there and you can pick it up. I do have one schedule announcement that I've been making people aware of, and that is that we are going to be having a spring break ourselves coming up, or myself coming up, ourselves, and that will be March 30th through April 5th. And that means that this will be the last Sunday before that spring break. So we'll have Wednesday night as we always will have it, and then we'll be on break for a week, one Sunday, one Wednesday. And we will resume Bible class, therefore, on April the 6th, and that's a Sunday. So March 30th through the 5th of April, and be back in class on Sunday, April the 6th. Any questions about that? Everybody clear on that? Okay. The rest of the breaks and everything will be in the handout material that you'll get at the annual meeting. And we've got the annual meeting scheduled for the 20th of April. And somebody brought that to my attention that that's Easter. I don't care. I can't stand Easter. I don't celebrate the goddess Ishtar, so that's just another Sunday. That's right. Cecil will be. He's not going to be 80. He'll be 100. We're going to call you Methuselah. 79. Well, 79. You're only 9 years. No, you're only 8 years. No, not even that. 7 years. You're only 7 years older than my brother. My oldest brother's 72, right? He was born in November of 42. I'm just glad to be here. Yeah. But the rest of the break schedule will be given to you in the packet of information you get there. And so the only one you really need to know about from me is the spring break, because that's going to occur before the annual meeting. And so, all right. Anything else then? I think that'll pretty well do it. Okay. And now please, Romans chapter 13, once again, verses 11 through 14. My intention is to make today's Bible classes and Wednesday before the break the finishing up of this overview, or this kind of bird's eye view of the effectual working of these four verses. So then when we come back after the break, we'll start dealing, we'll land our plane and start dealing with the details of the passage. But for now, we're going to continue finishing out an appreciation for how this section is designed to effectually work. And this is what it says. It says, "And that knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying. But put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof." Andrew Newbold, would you lead us in prayer this morning? As we have shown before, and we've gone over, the section that we're dealing with here deals with the issue of godliness. And since it does, it's going to address the aspect of thinking, living, and laboring like God. And what you have there, as you well know by now, is verse 11 and 12a. As far as verse 12 goes, "The night is far spent, the day is at hand." That all has to do with the godly thinking. And there are some real adjustments that now have to be made about time in your mind and in your life and the way you view life. And a lot of this is going to be getting you to start to gain a perspective that is that of your father's when it comes to two major aspects of time: your own personal time and the time in which you live in this present dispensation of grace. And that's going to be a major part of what this is going to be about. The godly living then takes that thinking and now begins to deal with how you're going to put that thinking into effect in the details of your lives. And this is where you get the casting off of the works of darkness and putting on armor for the first time, the armor of light. And as I said before, this is a major, major moment in your life, because this is the very first time ever that you are really going to, in a real powerful and a real concerted way, you're going to face off or square off with the adversary's policy of evil. You don't put on armor for no reason, and certainly not armor of light. Light is one of the most important things to God. God is all about light, and there's a lot of things that we're going to learn about it, not here, but we're going to eventually learn a lot of those things. And that's going to be the battle that we're going to be in. We're going to talk a little more about that battle today. And we'll get into a lot of it then. But like I said in our last lesson, if there's any reluctance, and there could be, if there shouldn't be, but there could be, but if there's any kind of hesitancy, any kind of fear, any kind of anxiety or worry or wringing of the hands about what I talk about when I say squaring off against the adversary and his policy of evil, the satanic policy of evil, be very clear that verse 11 and 12a, the godly thinking, is going to make it so that if it works to do its effectual job, taking all that you have up to this point with that effectual working, that's going to be your great desire, because every aspect of godly thinking, and we've gone through 10 times now, 10 times your thinking has been renewed. And the doctrine that God has given you is renewing your mind. And just like Romans 12, 2 talked about, that we would be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And every time that godly thinking works, it produces, by what it does and says and how it effectually works, the desire for that, the desire for the godly living. That's where it wants to go. And it's just going to be kind of like any soldier who has been properly prepared in boot camp. The last thing he wants is to be a garrison soldier. The last thing that he wants, some of you don't know what that means, but the last thing that he wants is a stateside desk job. He wants to go out and fight. That's what he was trained for. In fact, some of those loony Marines that we have running around this church one of them in particular was so upset that his brothers got to see more combat than he did that he changed his MOS and he changed his whole MOS just so that he could go and fight the enemy and actually get that combat experience. That's what he was trained for. If you ever want to see a frustrated Marine, you'll see one who's gone through his career and never actually engaged the enemy. But this is, and there's nothing to fear about it. You've got the skill sets, you've got the power, you've got the wisdom, you've got the armament, you've got everything that you need to be victorious. By the way, you're not being thrown in here against all the wiles of the devil. You're not. That's the deep end of the pool. You're starting at the shallow end. You're starting off with some of those tribulations and distresses that are going to come your way. But there is a battle coming, and we cannot avoid it. It is unavoidable if we're going to continue on. If you want to avoid it, then all we have to do is become like every other mainline denominational church, and like just about every other church you can imagine, and not take the Word of God seriously. Do you know how few churches there are in this world that even teach the Bible verse by verse anymore? I mean, it's almost unheard of. And I'm talking about even among grace churches that do rightly divide the word of truth. And they do see the epistles of Paul to be our marching orders today. And yet it's basically topical ministries. And these kinds of things, while they may produce great truth, it's not strung together, put together, the way God intended it to be put together, and therefore godly edifying to the degree God wants it to take place isn't taking place. This is one of the big problems we face. And one of the things we're going to do is we're going to enter into a battle where the adversary for 2,000 years has pretty much had it his way. There's been some pushback, but not much. And there's going to be some thinking that gets changed. We're going to delve into things here that are going to be real interesting to you, I'm sure. Like the timing of this dispensation of grace, the end of this dispensation of grace. Do you know that most believers today think about, if they even believe the rapture, think about it entirely wrong? I'll tell you why a little later on. But that's the godly living and the behavior and the conduct. And finally, we'll be laboring with our Father in one of the great open, privileged vistas of opportunity for the next order of His business to take place by putting on the Lord Jesus Christ and making not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. Well, as we were talking in our last lesson about some of these issues that we're going to be dealing with here when it comes to time and what time, and basically that's kind of going to be the overall theme of what's going to be going on in these these next four verses is, do you, you know, there was a song that came out, I think it was by Chicago back in the 70s or something. Does anybody know what time it is? Do you really know what time it is? Well, a son knows that what time it is. And that's one of the things that we're going to deal with and cover here. But we've been talking about how that a lot of the things that we're going to be doing here in the godly conduct and behavior, casting off works of darkness. And then we have a listing of some of those works that are going to be very integral to our understanding of the way the adversary has put his policy of evil together. And we have this list of six things. We're going to walk honestly as in the day. We're getting some terminology here that's going to be carried over into all the way into level two of our sonship education. And we have these issues of rioting and drunkenness, they go together. Chambering and wantonness, they go together. Strife and envying, they go together. You have three sets of two particular works of darkness that are mentioned there. Those aren't just random sins that the Apostle Paul points to. Those are some particular works of darkness for a particular reason that are some of the staples of the adversary and what he's trying to get accomplished today in his, for lack of a better expression, for his edification. There's some things that he is edifying the human race into. He has his own plan and purpose and program for this, for people, for human beings, for humanity in this dispensation of grace. He knows what time it is. And there's something that he knows about that you don't. But by the time we get to the end of this, you're going to know it too. There's an awful lot the adversary knows, by the way, that you don't know. And one of the things he's very well aware of is what time it is. And one of the things I went over, and I'm going to go over this again here just real quickly this morning, because this is going to be a chart that we're going to use quite a lot coming up. And this is our old timeline chart. And I know there are some who are here and some who come who haven't been with us from way, way, way back. And I don't want to make this too elementary for most of the folks, but I still want to make sure that we're all on the same page. And all I've done is take our timeline chart and shove everything down this way a little bit. I did this on Wednesday night. I'll just very briefly go back over it. But you have the law being the significant event. The top five numbers up there are the five courses of punishment, Leviticus 26. The five red numbers on the bottom are the five installments to the fifth course of punishment that Israel is going to go through. The green dots with the R, the D, the A, the K, and the B stand for the five mandates of the Davidic covenant. One of the reasons why the Psalms, the book of Psalms, is divided up into five books is that they follow those matters in that order. That one of the things the Davidic covenant covenanted for is that God in his Jehovahness was going to be their redeemer, that's the R, their deliverer and avenger, that's the D and the A, their king and their blesser. And that's what Israel has to have as a nation, not only individually, but as a nation, to be spiritually fit for God's service. They deal with that whole issue of God being for them everything they need to have him be, but they cannot be themselves. So that's briefly what that's about. I mentioned that because I'm going to come back to some of those things. But I want to work with this section right in here, and this isn't drawn to scale. So don't think that this is in any way close to being drawn to scale. But we talk about those first five chapters, especially in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. You have the issue of creation and the Garden of Eden and no sin on the earth. There's sin in existence. There's sin in existence in the heavenly realm, but there's no sin in existence on the earth in chapters 1 and 2. God declares everything that it was very good, and he gets to work with Adam to begin to not only make Adam the monarch of the earth, but God's going to have the view to this. If you think about, and there's a reason why God did everything the way he did. I'm not going to get sidetracked. But you have 1 7-day week, and on the seventh day God rested. The very next week, the next weekend, that next Saturday on our calendar, the days I would not think about, but I would think you've got day 1 through day 7 on the original creation week. The next week after that, the next 6 days was going to bring in the next order of business And on that that next seventh day, or the 14th day after creation, on day 14, God was to bring his eternal New Jerusalem, heavenly city, down and put it upon the beams of his chambers. But before that took place, Genesis 3 happened, and Satan struck. Now, that was such a big deal to God, and we know that's what God was going to do, because he blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. He did two things to the seventh day. He blessed it, and he sanctified it. And God doesn't sanctify something that he isn't going to use. He's going to use that. And he actually incorporates this into one of Israel's feasts. It's the only feast, the Feast of Tabernacles, the only feast that has that unique ending to it, where they have a celebration on the second Sabbath after the first. That's in commemoration of what God was going to do, but got interrupted with. And so Genesis 3, 4, and 5, you have that period of time, even though that you can take that portion of God's Word and squeeze it between your fingers, and it's extremely thin. You have that period of time that when Peter down here looks back at it, he says that was the world that then was. He calls that the world of the ungodly and the old world. And there is, you have to understand a significant line of demarcation in the way God looks at his creation and at the world at large is with Noah's flood. Noah's flood in Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9 is the difference between almost night and day. Don't use those two expressions literally. But this world was vastly different than the new world order that God brought into effect after the flood of Noah, when God made adjustments to everything. He made some adjustments to creation. He made some adjustments to man. And he made some adjustments so that what Satan was able to accomplish in a short order would take a very long period of time. That will all be recovered. We're going to go back over that later on in our passage in Romans 13, especially there in verse 13. But then you have this event. You have the next event was in Genesis 10 and 11, the raising up of the Tower of Babel, and there was a particular individual involved with that by the name of Nimrod. In fact, I want you to come back there for just a moment and look at something. Come back to Genesis chapter 10. One of the portions of God's Word that there's so little said about it, but has such incredible significance. Genesis chapter 10. Now this is after the ark has taken place, the flood is over, Noah and his sons have got going, and you have the kind of the listing of the way that the nations were spread abroad there in Genesis chapter 9, at least where Noah and his sons were concerned and everything. And you have the account of Canaan being cursed and this kind of thing. And again, God sees the world as a family story. And you have the line of your line and mine. And this is something, there's not a person in this room that yet realizes the full extent. And we get away from it, and we get away from it too much. And what we get away from is reminding ourselves just who we are. We are, or who we were. We were Gentiles. And we like to think, I think it's hilarious. Every time I hear people, you know, we live over here somewhere in the dispensation of grace. We live in 2014. And they made this movie, Noah, we were talking about before Bible class, and Hollywood is kind of going back through a resurgency. They go through these waves of making movies that pander to the Christians because they know that they can get an audience and get the movies full of people and make money off of it. And so they come along, and with newer technology, they make ooh-ah movies about certain things about the Bible. But the way it's always talked about is, we're going to make a movie that's set back in Bible times. Back in Bible times. That kind of thinking has got serious problems. We've never left Bible times. We are in Bible times. Now, we've got some people who teach some things that are so much Bible times that they're completely screwed up. There are people, and a lot of them today, who are teaching from pulpits all over America this morning about signs and wonders. And that we're to look for these signs, that signs are happening, and prophecy is being fulfilled all around us, and all this kind of business. And they're just as dead wrong as the people who say, well, back there was Bible times, but this isn't. This is Bible times. And what we fail to realize, and what most Americans especially American Christians fail to realize, is just how Gentile they really are. I dare say that I could go into every one of your homes and I could find something in your house that goes back to that tower. Or what came from the Tower of Babel. Most people have no idea what came from it. You go now. Don't go searching through your house and throw it out like leaven or something. It's unavoidable. You say, "Well, not in my house." I know what some of you say. You're right. You're now. You're just running through every room of your home, and you're thinking, "Well, what is in there?" I bet I could find it in your kitchen. How many of you in your kitchen have a calendar? Let's see, what was yesterday? What was the day yesterday? What? Saturday? Where did the term Saturday come from? Saturn's day? We don't realize how we're ruled and governed by the system that got started by Nimrod back there. Verse 1 says, now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. By the way, those aren't in chronological order there. But and unto the sons, Noah's right. But and to them were the sons born after the flood. The sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog. By the way, these names come up again. Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshech and Tyrus. The sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz and Rephtha and Togarma. The sons of Javan, Elisha and Tarshish, Kittim and Dodanim. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. By the way, you're getting a flavor there as to how God views the breakdown and hierarchy of the human race. He sees them as families. He still does. He still sees the people of this world in families, tongues, nations. And the sons of Ham, Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan. And the sons of Cush, Seba and Havilah and Sabta and Rama and Sabtika. And the sons of Ramah, Sheba and Dedan. If you're interested in names there, boy, there's a bunch of them. And Cush begat Nimrod. Now, again, think back through that. Cush is whose son? Ham. And Cush begat this guy named Nimrod. I know years ago I taught badly and wrongly that Nimrod wasn't a real man. But we're going to set that thinking aside as just my dark period. Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty hunter in the earth. I want you to see exactly what this guy began doing under the policy of evil that he was being was under at that time. It says in verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, and the beginning of his kingdom. This guy immediately set about to produce a kingdom on this earth. And this was under the auspices of the adversary of Satan and his policy of evil to begin to establish a kingdom on this earth. He, right after the flood, Satan is going, once again, getting right after establishing a stronghold upon this earth. And the beginning of it, it says, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. And then there's some others, Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. And if you're not familiar with where the land of Shinar is, it's located over there between the Euphrates and the Tigris River in what we know now as Iraq. It was where ancient Assyria and Babylon came from. Shinar being the hot spot for the Assyrians, and then the Babylonians through Babylon right there. But it all began right here. Well, I wanted you to see that. I wanted you to see something else, that as if we were to spend, well, in fact, let's look at look at chapter 11. This of course is the dealing with the Tower of Babel. It says, "And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said to one another, go to, let us make brick and burn them throughly. And they had brick for stone and slime they had for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build up a city and a tower." Now they're going to start with all of these things are counterfeiting what God was intending to do here on earth and establish his residence on earth. They're now going to establish theirs on this earth. And they're going to start to establish a city now. And they're going to establish this kingdom on this earth with this particular city. And so it said, "Let's build us a city and a tower whose top may reach into the heaven. And let us make an..." And they're going to try to... By the way, they understood that it didn't. And they're going to try to make the heavens and the earth respond to one another in ways that they knew that it could. They knew that there was power to be tapped out there. We look at it as just this dead space, but there's enormous power to be tapped out there. The heavenly place is by God's design, designed to be able to respond to the earth the way that you, as your human physical body, responds to your soul and spirit. In fact, your body responds to your soul. Your spirit is kind of buffered between the soul and it doesn't directly respond to it. And what I'm after is that when you see the correlation of that in the way your own body, your human body manifests what your soul, what's in your soul, what's going on with your soul. It could be good or bad. You can be anxious and have sweaty palms, or you can be you can be anticipating with dread something and sweat start coming. All of these kinds of things. There's great power to be tapped, and they were attempting to do that. And God had to step in here. This Nimrod, by the way, far from being an idiot, and it's one of my pet peeves whenever I hear somebody call somebody a Nimrod, and they're trying to say that they're a fool. Nimrod was one of the greatest geniuses in all the Bible. You call somebody a Nimrod, you're calling them a genius. But they're going to build a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. Let us make a name. A name. That's a big issue with God. His name, he's going to make that a big issue with the guy that he raises up in the very next chapter. No, take chapter 11 sometime and see how chapter 12 plays right off of it. God comes along and says, you're not. He judged this and he said, you're not going to build a kingdom. You're not going to build a city. That's what I'm going to do. And you're not going to have a name. I'm going to have a name. And it says, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. By the way, this was the original United Nations. That's where the United Nations all comes from. The Tower of Babel. Or Babel. So he says, then the Lord came down to see the city and the tower with the children, which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. By the way, if you read that, you can't help But notice that even though the details aren't all spelled out there, whatever they're going to do here is going to be absolutely ungodly. God is going to have to step in and stop this from taking place, or else it's going to be to their own destruction. And we'll maybe deal with some of this a little bit later on, but I'm doing this for a reason this morning. He says, go to, let us go down there and confound their language. By the way, just as an aside, anytime you hear a Bible teacher, preacher come along and say, yeah, the Tower of Babel, I know where that was. That's where God confused the languages. God is not the author of confusion. He did not confuse the languages. He confounded them, and there's a difference. Believe me, the people who spoke the same language weren't confused at all. They knew exactly what the other person was saying. But this is where we have multiplicity of languages. One of the things God does is one of the best ways to judge this thing and disperse these people is to give them multiple languages. You take 10 people, or you take 50 people, 10 each from 10 different languages, throw them in one room together and watch what happens. They all bunch up. They will immediately bunch up around the people who they can communicate to and with. So it's an ingenious part of God's judgment here. It says, so the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. By the way, there's another guy that's going to come along and build it, pick it back up. And then he's going to have something go wrong with him, and there's going to be another guy raised up down here who's going to actually try to do it again. So the Lord scattered them, and therefore in verse 9 is the name of it called Babel, or Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. All right? Then, hang on right there, but as time now marches on, from that point on, the next thing that you have in your Bible is chapter 12, God raises up Abraham. And he is immediately going to, and that was an immediate threat to the possession of this earth. And what I want you to kind of see by this chart is we'll use it time and time again without going over it like this. The part on the top of the black line, the main black line, is basically God's working. And the way God is effectually working. And with Abraham, he raises up Abraham out of... There's no Jews on the earth. Right? All you have are Gentile nations. And he takes a man out of one of the hotbeds for the worshiping of the creature more than the Creator. And you have to be able to plug in here. Everything that Paul talked about in Romans chapter 1 is now taking place. The Tower of Babel is where God, in Romans chapter 1, he looks at the Gentiles to see if there's anybody that's going to be able to be utilized for his purpose in repossessing this earth. And the Gentiles so rejected God and so worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever, that God gave them up. He gave them up again, and then he just gave them over to the adversary. And that's your heritage, and that's mine. You and I were twice dead Gentiles. We were dead in the trespasses of our sins and in the uncircumcision of our flesh. That's what our Apostle Paul declares to us later on. And one of the things you've got to get a healthy respect for somewhere along the line is just how Gentile you are and how fantastic it is that God has interrupted his program with Israel to bring in what I oftentimes call, and maybe some of you don't even know why I use the expression, he brought in this dispensation of Gentile grace. And it's a marvelous thing and glorious thing that God has done for 2,000 years. One of the problems is, like I said, we were kind of born in this river that we have, we're just under its influence. And we were born right into it, where for thousands of years it's been running full throttle, and we were just in its stream of influence until the day we were saved and taken out of that thing. And some of us haven't quite dried off yet. But God is now going to repossess this earth, beginning with this man Abraham, whose father was an unbelieving Gentile moon and sun worshiping. He looked at the moon and the sun as gods and worshiped them. And yet God was able to raise this man up. And through his line, through three men that now become family in God's sight, Abraham, his son Isaac, and grandson Jacob, he is going to take that line and he's going to repossess this earth with it. He's going to interrupt that program and he's going to bring in a new dispensation of Gentile grace where he's going to form another new man. Just as he miraculously caused Abraham, and that's one of the great things we talked about before, that God demonstrated with Abraham twice, both with the birth of his son Isaac and with his grandson Jacob. He demonstrated that God himself was doing this. There were two miraculous births there. There's going to be a third miraculous birth that's going to take place when the Lord Jesus Christ comes into this world. This nation that he's creating, Israel, is the nation of his own creation. In fact, the actual word nativity is applied to the nation of Israel. Israel had their nativity. But that's what God's plan for the earth. He never said anything about his plan for the heavenly realm until he raised up the Apostle Paul and revealed the mystery that he had kept hidden secret in himself since the world began. And Paul began to extol and expound this new program, this new dispensation of the grace of God that now has its eyes set on the heavenly realm. Have you got any idea what that did to Satan when that was revealed? The answer to that is no, you don't. But you're about to. By the time we get done with Romans 13, you will know something of how incredibly disastrous that was to Satan and what he had to do. I mean, when you think about the fact that he suddenly had revealed that he was going to lose the largest part of his realm, the heavenly realm, to this one new man, don't you think for a moment that he hasn't got every bit of his power and his effort trained like a laser? You hear all this crap about politicians. Well, we're going to have be a laser. Oh, they wouldn't know a laser from a hole in the ground. But Satan is focused like a laser upon this one new man. And he has tactics and wiles to destroy its effectualness and effectiveness. And one of the things that he has at his disposal is the fact that everything that has been happening with mankind from the time, actually, of the Tower of Babel until this present moment, even in this dispensation of grace, is marching humanity back to that tower. That's where we're going in this world. That's where we're going in this nation. You elect a president, he's going to take us back to that. I don't care which one it is. We are marching back to that. That's the stream in which humanity is moving. We're not moving up and better and, oh, we're more this and more that. We're moving back to Babylon. Now, I say Babylon and I point to the Tower of Babel. Nobody asked me this in Bible class the other night. But the fact of the matter is, that's not called Babylon. Where is Babylon on that timeline chart? When it becomes incredibly important to Israel's program. Now you know where it is. Just think. Look at the chart and think. Where does Babylon become a major issue? Where? Yeah, you overshot the field. Where does it first become? Where? Which, okay. Which captivity? So where's that on the chart? Second is Medo-Persia. First course of punishment. Right here. Good. I want you to think. This is the, I'll put an A, B, the Assyrian-Babylonian captivity. Under Nebuchadnezzar. This was the 70 years that Israel went under Babylonian captivity. Daniel goes out into Babylon and Daniel writes all that tremendous detailed prophecy about the remaining time schedule that Israel was going to go through and all those kinds of things. But even though that was Babylon, and by the way, that's where you have the, I'm not going to get in, I'm killing my time here. But we'll get to some of these details. What I'm after is this, though, even though this is you have the Babylonian part of this, it comes out of Assyria. That's because of what really began taking place all the way back at the Tower of Babel. It never got dealt with again. It's just been growing and growing. Israel becomes infected by it. They do some crazy things, and God's going to have to deal with this issue of Babylon. Now, the reason I say back to Babylon and I point back here is because Babylon, or the Tower of Babel and everything that happened there with Nimrod, is what spawned Babylon. And so Babylon becomes the big issue because it's directly tied to the tower and to Nimrod and to all that was taking place out there. And by the way, it's from those things that we get the corruption of the zodiac. We get all of these goofball mystery religions that come up with all of their phallic symbols and the integration of sex and religion. And these kinds of things all start to take place back there. And the thing I was talking about on Wednesday night, did anybody go and check that out? When I was talking about all the rich people who go to this pagan thing, it's the Bohemian. It's a Bohemian something or other. And you looked at me like I was crazy. You don't know what he's talking about. I do know what I'm talking about. You look it up, that Bohemian thing where all the powerful people of the world meet, the whole so-called Illuminati, and the president goes there, and nobody else can go in the Bohemian Grove. They go to their groves. This actually goes on. They say, oh, it's just a party of some really rich people. And it is. It's just a party of some really rich people. And then on the last night, they have all this ritual, and people come out in costumes, and they have a great big fire, and they burn the effigy as they're burning. It's the sacrifice of care. And they're going to burn care. They're supposed to go back then carefree. Well, heavens, if you have $1 billion in your hip pocket, you're pretty carefree from a lot of things in this life. And then there's all kind of conspiracy theorists, and they say, oh, they're choosing the next presidents of all the nations and everything from the Bohemian Groves and all that kind of stuff. And it's been going on for years, folks. But it just goes to show you what rich people will throw their money away on. And it goes right back to a lot of these Babylonian traditions and a lot of the traditions that came and were spawned by the Tower of Babel and what all got started under Nimrod back there and those kinds of things. We have the corruption of all of that filters down to ancient mythology, Roman mythology, Greek mythology, all of those kinds of things under which we still are under the influence of today, because you are a Gentile after all, and so am I. So the issue is for the adversary to get us back there. Unless you think this is just me talking, let's look at what Eric mentioned before. Come over and see when God finally settles all of these matters. Come over to the book of the Revelation. Come to the 17th chapter. Come to the book of the Revelation, chapter 17. When the Lord has His day of wrath and Jesus Christ comes back and He does battle upon this earth to finally settle the score with the adversary and take possession of this earth as He rightfully earned the right to it, to have dominion as the monarch of the earth at the cross, when He did battle with the adversary there, and then all dominion was given unto Him, but He hasn't taken the dominion quite yet. There are some other things that He's going to have to accomplish when He finally does come back. This is the section that a lot of people look at, and prophecy writers just go nuts with this section. And this is one of our great problems that we're going to address and some of the things we're going to be going over, and that is historical red herrings. I will say at the outset, and it's just me talking now, but hopefully by the time we get done corroborating this, you'll realize anybody who says this is a sign of the end, you're going to not be rude to them, you know, you're going to hospitality, all that kind of thing. But you're going to, in your mind, you're going to say that is absolutely unbiblical. There isn't one single sign, including this airline that went down, nobody can find it. That's not a sign. There are no signs today. None. Zero. None. It's not a sign that something is getting ready to happen. There's only one thing. Well, in fact, I'm going to get ahead of myself again. I'll stop. So we're not looking for the rise of a Roman Empire. We're not looking for a pope or any other goofball ideas that come down along here. But this is what it really means. It really means what it really says. There's a novelty. Verse 1. There came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials. And by the way, one of the things that you need to appreciate, my understanding of the book of the Revelation is you have these bowl judgments, the vial judgments, you have three series of judgments. And the way most prophecy writers take the book of the Revelation is they take those things and almost as it were, they say, well, here's from here to here, time-wise, there's the first one, then you have a second set of judgments, and then you have a third set of judgments. That's not the way that's written. Those judgments in the book of the Revelation, you have one set of judgments, and then the second set of judgments comes back around, and it loops back. You have looping parallelism. And then you have the second set of judgments that cover the exact same period of time. And I know this is true because all three of those judgments end at the same place. Then it loops back again, and you have a third set of judgments that takes place. The three judgments that you have in the book of the Revelation all loop back and give further detail to that same span of time. And we don't have time to go through all of that, but that's what's happening here with these seven angels, with these seven vials. This is, again, a further understanding of what's been going on in the period of time that we call that great tribulation period. And one of the last things God is going to do is to deal with what got started back there at the Tower of Babel, what got really blown up into major proportions by Nebuchadnezzar under the Babylonian captivity and the Babylonian Empire, and that whole Babylonian system who has its mother rooted back there in the Tower of Babel has been a particular problem in Israel's history and has been a particular area in which the adversary has exploited all throughout human history. Bible times, including today. And here's where he's finally going to deal with it. There came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, and I will show thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. And there's some imagery that's going on here about the waters and how they represent the nations and the kings of the earth, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk. You know, it's interesting the terminology that he's using here. Fornication, drunk, with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. By the way, John is one of the few guys in the Bible that really got to do some time traveling. John was taken into the Lord's day of wrath. There at the very beginning of the book of the Revelation, when John says, I was taken into the Lord's day, that doesn't mean that he was taken into Sunday morning church. He's talking about that day over there. He's not talking about Sunday. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones. So what's she doing with these stones? And pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon, the Great, the Mother of Harlots and the Abominations of the Earth. And then he's going to go on and he says, and I saw, we'll leave it there, but he's going to go on and he's going to actually, if you want to know what those things mean, read the rest of the chapter. Because the angel's going to explain what they mean. If you still don't know what they mean, you're going to have to go back and dig them all out of Daniel and Zechariah and some other places. But that's not talking about some imagery of Roman Catholicism or some imagery that alludes somehow to the next revived Roman Empire. That is talking about Babylon. It's talking about going back to that tower, what was spawned from it, and the Babylonian Empire that came from that, and the influence that Babylon has had on Gentiles and on this world ever since. There's something particular about that and the policy of evil that God has to specifically deal with himself, and he does. In fact, let me show you that. Go to the next chapter, chapter 18, verse 1. He says, "And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and is become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird." We talked about this verse when we were talking about the zoo that God is going to actually establish, where he puts these unclean spirits of Babylon in there for men to see during the time of the millennial kingdom. And he goes on and says, "For all nations," notice how many of them, "all nations have drunk the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies." That's terminology talking about the influence that the Babylonian, that system, that Babylon has had upon this earth, and upon the kings of this earth, and upon the nations of this earth. It is woven into their fabric. You've lived with it, you've slept with it, you've breathed it. You have no idea how permeating it is to who you are. That's one of the reasons why all the renewing of the mind that has to take place and becoming godly is such a big issue. Look at verse 10, same chapter, chapter 18, "Standing afar off, as the fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas, the great Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is thy judgment come." This is going to take place very quickly out there. And the nations are just going to, oh no, the worst thing that will ever happen to the nations of this world is to destroy that Babylonian system. They're going to despise Christ for taking that away from them. It's been their fornication, it's been their joy, it's been their delight, it's been their revelry, it's been their rioting, it's been their drunkenness, it's been everything that has fueled who they are. You came out of that, so did I. You said, why is Mark picking on me? I just watched Andy Griffith when I was a kid. It's all right, it's in Andy too, it's there. The last time Babylon is ever mentioned is in verses 20 and 21. Look at it. Chapter 18. The last mention of it. We just saw the first mention of Babel back there in Genesis chapter 10. Here's the last mention of what that genius back there spawned. Pick it up at verse 20. It says, "Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her. And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all." Interesting. Started out to build them a city. Started out to build them a kingdom. Started out to build them a name. And conspired to have Israel wiped off the face of the earth. And you'll find the prophets who talk about the way the enemies of Israel and the nations of Israel confederate and conspire against her to wipe her off the earth and have no more mention of her at all. And yet the way it ends is that Babylon is the one that gets destroyed and is found no more at all. Well, what I wanted you to see was the development of Babel to Babylon, and we haven't seen anything. We can't even say we've scratched the surface. I've just pointed you to a couple of passages. But you see how this thing begins, and you see how it ends, and you see one of the central features of this world is Babylon. Well, we're going to stop right there, and we'll pick this up after the break, but I took way too long on that, so we may cut some things short. We'll see. But when we get back, we're going to come back to Romans. Instead of back to Babylon, back to Romans. But I'll tell you what, I've learned some things. And it's amazing what we're going to get in these four verses in Romans 13. So we'll stop right there and we'll come back after a little break.